Hello, this is Brian, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 25th issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Mark Carney, to unveil tariff response, says Donald Trump's threats shows U.S. wants to destroy Canadian industries. The trade war with the United States has descended into open acrimony, with Ontario's premier trading personal insults with Donald Trump as Prime Minister Mark Carney warns that the U.S. President's new tariff threat on Monday shows Washington wants to destroy major Canadian industries like the auto and steel sectors. The federal government is now planning to unveil its response to the latest round of import duties imposed over the weekend on Tuesday, along with measures to support businesses and workers impacted by the fallout, the Prime Minister's office confirmed. With the stakes escalating after near-deal talks collapsed last week, Premier Doug Ford took full aim at Trump, telling a radio station that U.S. President can kiss my ass before lampooning him at a Hamilton press conference as a dictator and a loser. Trump, in turn, tarred Ford as Carney's flunky and said the Ontario leader is the less charismatic, intelligent, and overall unimpressive brother of the late great Rob Ford, the former Toronto mayor. Calling on other provinces to support his call to tax electricity sales to the U.S., Ford told reporters that he relishes how Trump will react if Canada decides to take that step, with Carney confirming that all options remain on the table as the country prepares for challenges on the road ahead. Watch how he does cartwheels and he shouts and screams when we put the surcharge on, the premier said. Matter of fact, I can't wait. I cannot wait. Let's be clear, I don't like the guy. In Lévis, Quebec, Carney struck his own combative tone, describing the U.S. under Trump as one of the lone, unreliable trading partners in the world, alongside Russia, where authoritarian President Vladimir Putin has faced international condemnation and sanctions for his ongoing war in Ukraine. The Prime Minister also shrugged off Trump's Monday threat to raise tariffs on autos and steel to 50% on January 1st. U.S. tariffs on Canadian autos currently sit at 25%, while levies on steel range from 10% to 50%. Asked about the threat, Carney said in French that the U.S. wants to destroy the large industries, including the automobile industry, the steel industry, the aluminum, with their terms of negotiations, which are not fair. In that light, Canada is not willing to return to trade talks with the Trump administration until the Americans show they're willing to forge a true partnership that doesn't infringe on Canadian sovereignty, Carney said. Carney had previously said he suspended trade talks on Friday despite being on the cusp of a deal to reduce American tariffs that Canada sees as unjustified after a series of late demands from the U.S. that included limits to the promotion of French language content online, restrictions on Canada's ability to strike trade deals with other countries, and the exclusion of trucks like those made at major factories in Oshawa and Oakville from tariff relief. An attitude at the negotiating table that Canada is a subsidiary of the United States, that the Canadian industry is going to be disadvantaged relative to American industry, that we're going to set up terms that over time the Canadian industry is going to face constant headwinds, that's not something we're going to accept, Carney said. But Carney stopped short of threatening specific new actions against the Americans, besides the already planned retaliation to match the latest round of U.S. tariffs on $28 billion of Canadian goods, which the Prime Minister said is being drawn up now in consultation with provincial premiers. While it will be difficult to match all American tariffs dollar for dollar, Nothing is excluded from a possible Canadian response, Carney said. We will be calm, we will be positive, we will cooperate to build real jobs, real careers here in Quebec and across Canada. Carney said in French, announcing his government will spend $11 billion to build 6 Coast Guard icebreakers, a decision he billed as a significant move to bolster the Canadian economy and sovereignty at an uncertain time. The intensifying trade war, however, is likely to drag Canada's economic prospects, with sectors hard hit already facing possible steeper tariffs and the fallout of any further escalation, said Don Desjardins, chief economist at Deloitte. Likely we'll see a slowing in the economy as a result of all this uncertainty, she said. The Trump administration has justified steep tariffs on Canadian autos, steel, and aluminum by claiming these imports threaten U.S. national security, a position that has previously prompted Carney to conclude publicly that some level of tariffs would likely remain in any deal. Ford told reporters on Monday last week, as a deal appeared imminent, the Ontario Premier was among those who urged Carney to refrain from accepting it, arguing that what was on offer would ultimately disadvantage Canada. The opposition Conservatives are now pressing the Carney government to release full details of the scuppered deal while the Canadians and Americans jockey over whom to blame for the current standoff. Campaigning for the midterm American elections in Maine, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance said the Canadians were the ones who made unreasonable demands at the last minute, while the Trump administration is merely pushing for trade fairness in areas like dairy, where Canada's protectionist supply management system has been a frequent complaint from Washington. A spokesman for Dominic LeBlanc, Carney's cabinet minister closely involved in the negotiations, declined an interview request from the Star on Monday, but LeBlanc told CBC News Monday evening that there was zero incoherence or lack of unity on the Canadian side of the table during the final days before the talks fell apart. Echoing Trump's comments on Monday, Vance claimed Canada would quite literally get invaded if not for U.S. military protection. He also accused Canada of becoming a backdoor to Chinese goods the Americans want to prevent from entering their country, and called on Carney to stop taking advantage of America. It's over. We expect fairness in our trade policy. On Parliament Hill, Bloc Quebec leader Yves Francois Blanchet called on Carney to bring back counter tariffs on U.S. goods that Canada removed last year, restore the digital services tax it canceled last year under U.S. pressure, and suspend the multi-billion dollar purchase of 88 American F-35 fighter jets that the federal government has been reviewing for more than a year. Ford made his own demands, urging Ottawa to drop climate policies to help businesses hit by U.S. tariffs, while calling for the federal government and the provinces to band together to make sure America's economy feels the pain. You know something, Ford said, addressing Trump directly. I've dealt with guys like you my whole life, and guess what? You all become losers because you are a loser. U.S. consumer confidence falls to lowest level in 7 months, with gas stuck above $4. Americans' confidence in the economy declined again this month as the ongoing conflict in Iran has steadily pushed gasoline prices above $4 per gallon in the U.S. The Conference Board said Tuesday that its consumer confidence index dipped to 89.4 in August from 90.2 in July. That's the lowest level in 7 months, but essentially in the same lukewarm range it's been in since the beginning of the year. In late 2024 and early 2025, the readings were consistently above 100. Respondents' views of their present situation improved, but their outlook for the near-term future soured. Americans remain frustrated with the economy after 5 years of elevated inflation, potentially posing a risk to President Donald Trump and Republicans in the midterm elections, which are less than 70 days away. Write-in responses to the board survey, which were collected from August 3rd to August 16th, were slightly more pessimistic this month. References to prices in general, specifically oil and gas specifically, remain elevated. Comments about war and geopolitics, food prices, trade, and jobs rose in August. Trump continues to blame the high prices on his predecessor, Democrat Joe Biden, yet inflation has risen since Trump's inauguration last year. The government's measure of inflation that the Federal Reserve prefers, personal consumption expenditures, came in at 3.7% in June, down from May's year-over-year increase of 4.1%, but up from 2.8% before the Iran war began February 28th. It was 2.5% when Trump inaugurated in January 2025. The government issues its July PCE data on Wednesday. Consumers' views of the current labor market improved in August, with 27% of consumers saying jobs were plentiful, up from 24.4% in July. However, they were more negative about the labor market going forward in the next 6 months, with just 14.6% of respondents expecting more jobs to be available. That's down from 16.4% last month. The U.S. job market stalled unexpectedly in July as employers cut 23,000 jobs. To make matters worse, Labor Department revisions slashed 103,000 jobs from May and June payrolls. The unemployment rate fell to 4.1%, but for the wrong reason. Thousands of people dropped out of the labor market, so fewer people were competing for work. FBI sets $25,000 minimum reward for dozens of unsolved Indian country cases. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has established a minimum reward of $25,000 in cases where people went missing or were killed in Indian country, part of a broader effort to address high rates of violence affecting Native American communities. The new minimum applies to more than 50 unsolved homicides and missing person cases in tribal communities. Most of the cases are less than 10 years old, though a dozen have been unsolved for more than two decades, an AP analysis found. Victims' families and experts are unsure the higher amounts will be enough to get tipsters to come forward, citing people's fears and distrust of the federal government. "Everybody's scared in Oglala," said Lisa Carlo, whose father, Patrick Carlo, Sr., was found dead in his Pine Ridge Reservation home in 2023. "So to me, it's like, okay, what do you guys know that you're not saying?" The FBI investigates federal crimes on nearly 200 Native American reservations, along with the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs. At the end of 2025, the FBI's National Crime Information Center recorded just under 1,500 active cases involving missing Native Americans, though not all become federal cases. The FBI cited several cases in its recent announcement, including that of 8-year-old Malika Boone, who it said was likely struck by a vehicle on the Navajo Nation, and San Carlos Apache teenager Emily Pike, whose body was found after she disappeared from an Arizona group home. Higher rewards could stir a new interest. Mary Catherine Nagel, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma and an attorney who advocates for families of missing Native Americans, said federal investigators often parachute in to investigate crimes in tight-knit communities where witnesses may stay silent because of distrust and fear of retribution. Still, she said, larger rewards could provide an incentive for people to talk and show families their loved ones' cases are being taken seriously. We have people in Indian country who know what happened to our relatives, she said. Luana Ross, who is Bitterroot Salish and a co-director of the Native Voices program at the University of Washington, said cash rewards could boost interest, but often aren't paid out. It is my opinion that in reservation communities, people would be extremely reluctant to turn a friend or relative into a criminal justice system that hasn't served them well, she said. Lisa Foster's longtime friend, Mona Renee Vallo, was found dead after a suspected hit and run along historic Route 66 in Laguna Pueblo, New Mexico in 2022. Foster hopes the higher reward money will renew interest in the investigation. Foster described Vallo as a positive, bubbly friend who could have fun no matter what. She was a member of the Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakama Nation. Someone knows something there, Foster said. They have to. I mean, it's weird that she went to work and then all of a sudden this happened to her. Frustration mounts as families seek answers. The reward in Carlo's case was increased to $25,000 in July, up from $10,000. Carlo's family says the 73-year-old rancher was respected in the Oglala community. He mowed the grass for others and spent time with his grandchildren. The family said more calls started coming in after the reward was increased, but the wait for answers continues. Meanwhile, the FBI declined to provide the Associated Press an update on the case. It's so hard to get your hopes up like that and think, this is it, we finally got Dad's killer, and then nothing comes of it, Lisa Carlo said. She said fear keeps community members who may have information from contacting authorities. I think that's like deep-rooted within our people, said her sister, Jody Carlo. It's not just on Pine Ridge, it's on every reservation. Relatives don't want cases to be forgotten. The FBI initially offered $5,000 for information in the deaths of two brothers from Ohio, Matthew and Philip Reagan. The reward was later doubled and now will hit $25,000. Though not Native Americans, they were killed on the Navajo Nation and are featured on the FBI's Indian Country Cases website. The brothers planned to visit Canyon de Chelly National Monument during a trip to California. Authorities believe their SUV got stuck in mud after GPS sent them off course near a sawmill. They were shot multiple times while walking to seek help, authorities said. Matthew Reagan's wife, Faye Wersner Reagan, said she doubts a $25,000 reward will persuade anyone in the small community to come forward. You would have to promise someone, like, actual protection, she said. I mean, they brutally murdered two men. She suggested the FBI instead put resources toward law enforcement to keep the cases from going cold and for light liaisons to keep families informed. FBI spokesperson Brooke Brennan in Phoenix said investigating crimes in Indian country often is complex because of the remoteness, limited resources, and extensive workload. Wersner Reagan hopes that families united in pain and grief over missing loved ones and unsolved killings might one day see justice. We're just getting forgotten, like no one is remembering any of us, and we're just told it's an active investigation, she said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The last few witnesses in the Lindsay Clancy murder trial are set to testify. After nearly a month of testimony, juries in the Lindsay Clancy murder trial are hearing Tuesday from the final witnesses in a case that has largely been about her mental state when she strangled her three young children. Testimony resumed from a forensic psychologist hired by prosecutors to evaluate Clancy's psychiatric history and assess the defense claim that she was suffering from acute postpartum psychosis when she killed the children at their Massachusetts home. Kirk Hullbrun told jurors Monday that he believed Clancy took her children's lives so they wouldn't suffer after she killed herself. He said he didn't believe Clancy's claim that she hallucinated a voice telling her to kill the children, the other possibility he considered. Everything I did as part of this evaluation, the evidence much more strongly in my opinion, supported the second explanation, which was the serious suicide attempt accompanied by killing the children out of love, Hillbrun said Tuesday. Hillbrun also said he concluded that Clancy was criminally responsible for the killings of her children. She retained an awareness of the illegality of killing others, including her children, he said. Her moral awareness of this killing was influenced by her strong desire to die and, if she was dead, not to leave her children behind. Clancy's lawyer, Kevin Reddington, will get a chance Tuesday to question Hillbrun about his conclusions. Prosecutors are then expected to call at least one more expert witness before the trial moves on to closing arguments, likely no earlier than Wednesday. Earlier in the trial, jurors heard from other medical experts called by the defense who said Clancy wasn't responsible for her actions because she had lost her grip on reality due to postpartum psychosis, a rare mental illness that can follow childbirth. In the months before killing her children, Clancy had sought treatment for mental health problems from multiple providers and admitted herself to a psychiatric hospital. After killing her children, Clancy jumped from a second-floor window. She remains paralyzed from the waist down. Prosecutors say the former labor and delivery nurse planned the killings and contrived to get her husband out of the house by sending him to pick up medicine for one of their children and dinner for the family. Clancy, 36, has pleaded not guilty to murder charges in the January 2023 deaths of Callan Dawson and Cora Clancy, who ranged from 8 months to 5 years old. Federal judge rejects Ghislaine Maxwell's miscarriage of justice claim and bid for prison release. Claims by Jeffrey Epstein's former girlfriend and longtime associate Ghislaine Maxwell that her sex trafficking conviction was a complete miscarriage of justice were rejected Tuesday by a federal judge who said her assertions were based on speculation, distortions, and or outright falsehoods. Judge Paul A. Engelmeyer said in a written ruling that Maxwell's habeas petition seeking to set aside her conviction and free her from a 20-year prison sentence on the grounds that there was substantial new evidence was demonstrably meritless. Maxwell's petition falls very far from the mark, Engelmeyer said. There is no fact that Maxwell fairly puts in dispute that has any potential to disturb the outcome of her trial. Maxwell maintained in a habeas petition last December that information that would have resulted in her exoneration at her 2021 trial was withheld and false testimony was presented to the jury. She said the cumulative effect of the constitutional violations resulted in a complete miscarriage of justice. A request for comment was sent to lawyers for Maxwell on Tuesday. Habeas petitions are often filed as a last resort and to protect against unlawful confinement after appeals are exhausted, as happened after Maxwell's conviction and sentencing. Epstein, a millionaire financier, was arrested in July 2019 on sex trafficking charges, ordered detained until trial. He was found dead in his cell at a New York federal jail in August 2019, and death was ruled a suicide. Maxwell, a British socialite, was arrested a year later and was convicted of sex trafficking in December 2021. She was interviewed by the Justice Department's second-in-command in July 2025 and was soon afterward moved from a federal prison in Florida to a prison camp in Texas. Secret Service confirms awareness of Iranian state media video threatening Barron Trump's life. The U.S. Secret Service has confirmed it is aware that Iranian state media has aired a video that appears to threaten the life of Barron Trump, President Donald Trump's youngest son. The U.S. Secret Service is aware of the video and investigates anything that can be perceived as a threat toward our protectees, Secret Service spokesman Nate Herring said in a statement. Out of concern for operational security, we do not discuss matters of protective intelligence. Since the U.S. assassination of Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iranian media have on multiple occasions circulated content threatening the president and family members. The assassination came at the start of the war in Iran that Trump launched alongside Israel. CNN previously reported that the Secret Service had knowledge of the Barron Trump threat. Trump's economic D-Day threats become warnings for countries to sever financial ties with Iran. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced a new round of sanctions aimed at Iran on Monday and warned every country that does business with the Islamic Republic to sever those financial ties or face retaliation from the United States. President Donald Trump's pledge last week to unleash an economic D-Day against Tehran turned out to be new warnings to cut off Iran from the rest of the global economy. Asked why the U.S. was not imposing secondary sanctions on Iran's trading partners, Bessent told reporters he wanted countries to have an opportunity to shift away from Iran before it was too late. "Why would I want to blow up the global financial system?" Bessent said. The Trump administration is struggling to find an off-ramp nearly 6 months into an unpopular war with an increasingly obstinate Iran. Diminishing stockpiles of key weapons appear to have forced U.S. officials to pivot to economic warfare, though Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said later Monday that he was not ruling out resuming strikes to hit Iran during a lull in hostilities. Washington had promised new sanctions would put even more pressure on an Iranian economy already battered by previous penalties and a U.S. naval blockade. But the announcement Monday provided little detail and did not name which countries could face secondary sanctions. China, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates are Iran's largest trade partners. "We are level setting with every country to tell them our expectations. We know who they are. They know who they are," Bessent said. "So when the hammer of U.S. Treasury actions falls upon them, they will have no one to blame but themselves." Dubbing the campaign Operation Economic Outcast, Bessent said Trump has been making phone calls to world leaders with specific requests to cease their interactions with Iran and has already seen results. The UAE announced last week that it was suspending all trade, commercial exchanges, and financial transactions with Iran until further notice after a reported missile attack on the Gulf country. Bessent said the UAE decision was not a coincidence. Shortly before the announcement, Iranian Parliamentary Speaker Mohammad Bagheer Kalibaf said the U.S. is not in an economic position to further restrict Tehran's relations with other countries. "Iran's trading partners, both in the media and through messages sent to us, have made it clear that they don't take these statements into account anywhere," Kalibaf, who has been Iran's lead negotiator over the past 6 months, posted on X. Bessent is pressed on what the new campaign means for China. Asked whether the U.S. would target China, Bessent said that no one is above the reach of U.S. sanctions, despite the fragile trade truce in place between the world's two largest economies. "If they facilitate transactions and are a part of the ecosystem that turns Iranian oil into money, into repression, they will be targeted," he added. Experts say the U.S. is likely to carefully calibrate its actions on China just a month before Chinese leader Xi Jinping is expected to visit the U.S. How much the announcement matters depends on the aggressiveness with which President Trump is willing to enforce it, said Ollie Wine, senior research and advocacy advisor for U.S.-China relations at the International Crisis Group. Thus far, despite threatening severe economic consequences for countries that do business with Iran, he has largely given China a pass. The Treasury Department said Monday that it was imposing sanctions on nearly 60 Iran-linked entities, accusing them of roles in Iran's nuclear and missile programs, cyber activities, and oil shipments. That includes Hong Kong-based Sweet Ocean Industrial Limited and associated people and businesses, which were accused of helping Iran acquire sensitive goods such as laser optics equipment. Also penalized was China-based Shenzhen Weimei, which is a service provider for the Iran-based logistics company BRE Line, as well as BRE Line's branch in Hong Kong for allegedly supporting the missile and nuclear programs. Iranian currency falls to a record low. Hours before Bessent's announcement, Iran's currency hit a record low. The rial dropped to 2.02 million to the U.S. dollar as trading opened on currency markets. Iran's official central bank rate stood at around 1.5 million rials to the dollar, but the market rate is what most Iranians pay. The currency had already been under pressure before the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran on February 28th, as Iran faced double-digit inflation and negative growth. The rial has repeatedly hit new lows as nearly 6 months of war have taken even greater toll. Iranians find daily staples increasingly unaffordable. Since the war began, rice is up some 60%. And beef prices are more than 150% higher. The International Monetary Fund forecasts that gross domestic product will contract more than 5%. Still, economic pressure has not yet translated into political pressure. Iran retains a key strategic advantage. Its attacks and threats on ships in the Strait of Hormuz have brought traffic in the vital waterway to a near halt, damaging the world economy and heaping pressure on U.S. President Donald Trump ahead of congressional elections. The war, as a result, has devolved into a fight over who controls the strait, through which a fifth of the world's traded oil transited before the conflict. Iran is now refusing to fully reopen it unless it can charge ships. Iran and Oman, which is on the opposite side of the strait, are reportedly in the final stages of agreeing on a plan for joint management of the waterway. Oman's foreign minister is set to visit Iran on Tuesday. Pakistani delegation visits Iran. Pakistan, which played a key role in brokering a 60-day ceasefire in June, sent a high-level delegation to Iran on Monday to encourage the U.S. and Iran to return to negotiations, two senior officials said. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak to the media. The military confirmed only Field Marshal Asim Munir's visit, saying it was aimed at de-escalating tensions in the region. Trump spoke with Munir ahead of the Army Chief's visit to Iran, according to a person familiar with the discussion who spoke on condition of anonymity to confirm a private conversation. Reuters, citing Pakistani sources, first reported the call. Munir met Iranian Interior Minister Askandar Momeni in Tehran, according to the two senior officials. Munir was accompanied by Pakistani Interior Minister Mohsin Naqvi and other officials. Munir was expected to remain in Iran overnight and meet the Iranian president and other senior officials before returning to Pakistan. His previous visit to Tehran in May helped pave the way for a memorandum of understanding signed by the U.S. and Iran in June. In downtown Tehran, 73-year-old Sadegh Mahmoudi, did not hold out hope for a resolution. He joined a line of about a dozen people to purchase U.S. dollars with his remaining savings to hedge against further declines. "There is no hope for a deal and peace," he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Iran warns of a harsh response as U.S. announces new sanctions and other Middle East news. Iran warned that new U.S. sanctions on Tehran announced Monday would not bring peace to the region. Meanwhile, Israeli and Syrian officials met less than a week after Israeli strikes in Syria, and Israel said it killed a Hamas commander in Gaza. Here's a look at the latest developments in the Iran war in the wider Middle East on Monday. Full coverage can be found here. Iran threatens response ahead of U.S. sanctions announcement. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson warned that Tehran would respond harshly to expanded U.S. sanctions, including measures against countries it sees as cooperating with Washington. "Any escalation of this situation will undoubtedly bring about consequences," Esmail Begay said. "Our hands are not tied." The new head of Iran's top security body warned Sunday that Tehran will see any country's support for the sanctions as an act of war. The expanded sanctions come after weeks of impasse. The United States has not dislodged Iran's grip on the Strait of Hormuz, through which a fifth of the world's traded oil passed before the war started nearly 6 months ago. Iran's demands for reopening the strait include lifting the U.S. naval blockade, withdrawing U.S. forces from the region, and reparations for damages sustained in the war. It has held separate talks with Oman on the other side of the strait on jointly managing the waterway, regardless of whether a new deal is brokered with the U.S. Sanctions have historically raised prices of basic goods in Iran, but after decades of withstanding them, Iran's economy has adapted through finding new trading partners and building domestic industries. The country's currency hit a record low on Monday. China warns new sanctions will escalate the situation. China said Monday that sanctions and additional pressure will not help resolve the issue, as the U.S. has threatened to impose secondary sanctions on countries that trade with Iran. "They will only exacerbate tensions and escalate the situation, which is in no one's interest," Foreign Ministry spokesperson Lin Zhen said during a daily briefing in Beijing. He added that China was calling on all parties to avoid measures that could further intensify differences and conflicts and disrupt global economy development and financial stability. China is considered the biggest buyer of Iranian oil and was importing more than 80% of Iranian oil before the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran. Netanyahu claims Iranian assassination attempt on his son. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Israel's Channel 14 television that Iran had attempted to assassinate one of his sons. He said that without security around his son, the attempt would have succeeded. "Iran targeted one of my sons. Iran tried to murder one of my sons," he said in a phone interview with the television station. Netanyahu did not say which son, where the attempt happened, what the attempt was, and how it was thwarted. His office also gave no further details when asked by the Associated Press. Israeli and Syrian officials meet following an Israeli airstrike. Syrian Foreign Minister Assad al-Shibani met over the weekend with a high-level Israeli delegation in Jordan to try to defuse tensions after Israel last week struck an airbase in northern Syria, Syrian state news agency Sana reported. The U.S. mediated discussions on Sunday focused on restarting negotiations for a future security agreement, Sana said. Israel struck the Abu Dhuhr airbase in Idlib province, saying it aimed to stop Turkey, which has supported the new Syrian government's efforts to rebuild its armed forces after 14 years of civil war, from establishing a presence there. Syrian officials during the talks asserted the right to develop an army and freely forge alliances with any country, Sana said. They also called for the withdrawal of Israeli forces from a buffer zone in southern Syria they have occupied since December 2024, and reiterated Syria's stance that the Golan Heights, which Israel captured in the 1967 Mideast War and later annexed, is Syrian territory. Israeli officials didn't immediately comment on the meeting. Israeli strikes kill 4 in Gaza, including 2 children. Israeli strikes killed at least 4 people Monday in the war-torn Gaza Strip, including 2 children, hospital officials said. In the Barish refugee camp in central Gaza, a strike hit a building after residents said they received an evacuation warning. A 4-year-old child was killed after his family was unable to flee, according to Auda Hospital. His mother and sister were wounded. 4 other structures, including mosques, were hit after residents said they received evacuation warnings, sending scores of already displaced Palestinians fleeing again. Smoke rose over a landscape of rubble and destroyed buildings as elderly people pushed wheelchairs or used canes, women carried babies, and others sprinted for safety. Commenting on some of the strikes, the Israeli military said it struck Hamas weapons storage facilities in mosques after issuing warnings, but provided no evidence. Separately, Israel said it killed a militant affiliated with Hamas's Special Forces unit in an overnight airstrike. Israel says it targets Palestinian militants who participated in the October 7, 2023 attack that sparked the war. Israel has announced targeted strikes on 6 of the 7 days since U.S. negotiator Jared Kushner's meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last week, hoping to push the ceasefire deal forward. At least 1,288 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire took effect last October, according to Gaza's health ministry, part of the Hamas-run government. Its numbers are generally considered reliable by the international community. A Palestinian American says he can't freely leave West Bank home. Louis Reedy had traveled from Ohio a week ago to join his relatives at his home in the village of Kusra in the occupied West Bank, which was besieged this month by Israeli settlers. He says he is unable to move freely. The Israeli military declared the area a closed zone to restore order in Kusra. Reedy said settlers returned throughout the week to the hill above his house. Since Israeli settlers surrounded the house more than 2 weeks ago, preventing occupants from leaving, Israeli soldiers have encouraged them to leave, but Israel's police have not announced arrests. The siege and Israel's response have sparked condemnation from Israeli rights groups and foreign officials, including U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee, who called the violence terrorism. Palestinians consider the West Bank home to some 3 million Palestinians and 560,000 Israeli settlers, the heart of any future state, and have condemned Israel's expansion there. This year has seen a dramatic spike in violence carried out by Israeli settlers against Palestinians. Trump administration removes Syria from blacklist. The Trump administration on Monday formally removed Syria from the U.S. State Department's blacklist of state sponsors of terrorism, making permanent a series of sanctions removals that had been initially announced more than a month ago. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio had announced the move in early July, but there was a 45-day period for congressional review before it was formalized. That review period has now expired, and sanctions related to the designation have been almost completely removed. the State and Treasury Departments said. Treasury is following through on President Trump's promise to give the Syrian people a chance at greatness, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said in a statement. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A year after Israeli strikes killed journalists at a hospital, no one has been held accountable. It's been a year since Israeli soldiers killed 22 Palestinians, including journalists and rescue workers, in a double strike on a hospital in Gaza. No one has been held accountable. Israeli officials said the target was a suspected Hamas camera on the roof of Nasser Hospital. Among those killed were Reuters cameramen Hussam al-Masri and Mariam Daga, a visual journalist who worked for the Associated Press and other news organizations. Despite repeated requests by AP, the Army hasn't provided details about the investigation or a timeline for when it could be completed. Rights groups say Israel rarely holds troops accountable for killing Palestinians, pointing to long investigations that rarely lead to prosecution. As global outrage over the August 25, 2025 strikes grew, the Israeli military said that in addition to taking out the camera, six of those killed were linked to Hamas without providing evidence. But an Israeli soldier, speaking on condition of anonymity for fear of retribution, now says the military could find no evidence linking the camera, which belonged to al-Masri, to Hamas. The soldier, who was privy to discussions surrounding the military's response, said none of the six was the intended target of the strikes. AP sent detailed questions to the military about the allegations, as well as other questions about the strikes. The military didn't address the questions, but said the incident is being examined, and findings will be transferred to the Military Advocate General's Corps to reach a verdict on whether to open a criminal investigation. It didn't provide a timeline. The Army said it would not comment on details while the incident was under review. AP reported at the time that one of the six Israel said was linked to Hamas wasn't on the hospital's list of casualties, and two others were medical or emergency personnel. That, along with the soldier's account, raises serious questions about Israel's rationale for the strikes. Why did troops fail to identify the cameraman as al-Masri, even though journalists were known to film at the hospital? Why did they strike a second time, causing most of the deaths and raising accusations of a double tap attack on first responders, which would be a war crime? AP and Reuters released a statement Tuesday calling again for Israel to provide a full explanation of the strikes. The news organizations also called on Israel to give journalists access to Gaza to support colleagues who have covered the war from the beginning. A year later, we remain devastated by their deaths and are still searching for answers from the Israeli authorities about what happened, the statement read. Nasser Hospital was a vital location for journalists. News agencies like Reuters and AP supply live video footage to newsrooms around the world from the hospital, one of the few functioning in Gaza at the time. AP repeatedly informed the Army that its journalists were there. The first strike killed al-Masri and another person, as other journalists, including Daga, and rescue workers rushed up an external staircase to help the wounded and document what happened. The military struck again, killing 20. Based on footage and eyewitnesses, none was armed. In all, Israel struck the hospital four times using high-explosive tank shells. Israeli officials afterward said Hamas was using the camera to observe nearby troops. They alleged suspicious behavior around the camera, but the only example they gave was that a towel draped over the camera and the person filming appeared to be an effort at concealment. Al-Masri routinely covered equipment with a white cloth to protect it from the sun and dust, a common practice among journalists in Gaza, and other hot climates. Last week, the Army announced criminal investigations into two other high-profile attacks by its troops in Gaza: the 2024 killing of 5-year-old Hin Rajab and her family, and the 2025 killing of 15 paramedics. It cleared troops in 3 other attacks that killed International Aid Group workers. Soldier details an attempt at damage control. The soldier was connected to AP through Breaking the Silence, a group founded over 2 decades ago by Israeli veterans that collects testimony from soldiers and is critical of Israel's actions in the Palestinian territories. The soldier said, after high-profile strikes that kill civilians without clear military purpose, Army officials search for militant links among those killed. Breaking the Silence said its testimonies show there is a retroactive incrimination process in which Palestinians who are killed are automatically counted as militants, even when unarmed. Retroactive incrimination is used as a near automatic justification for every bullet, shell, or missile fired, and as a tool used to avoid carrying out real investigations, Nadav Wyman, the group's executive director, said. AP confirmed some details of the soldier's account, which is consistent with the military's public response. Breaking the Silence said it corroborated the account with its own sources. The Israeli military has raided or laid siege to hospitals throughout the war, accusing Hamas of using them as command centers and hide fighters, though it's provided evidence for only some of its claims. Hamas security men have been seen in hospitals during the war, controlling access to certain areas. Earlier this year, Doctors Without Borders suspended some operations at Nasser Hospital for several months after patients and staff reported seeing armed, masked men roaming parts of the building. Tank shells were fired after a drone failed. The soldier and a former military official with knowledge of the situation said a high-ranking Army official initially approved use of a precision weapon to take down the camera, but an attempt by drone failed for unknown reasons. The former official spoke on condition of anonymity because they weren't authorized to talk to the media. The division commander then approved an alternative method, said the soldier, without saying what the method was. It's unclear who made the decision to fire tank rounds, which can cause more damage than drone strikes. Oded Alam, former head of the counterterrorism division in Israel's Mossad spy service, said while commanders on the ground have a degree of freedom, they don't have a blank check. If the change is significant, particularly where it may affect the risk to civilians, it must remain within the authority, rules, and intent of the original order, or require renewed approval, he said. Israeli troops have killed over 200 journalists in the war. Israeli troops have killed 207 Palestinian reporters in Gaza since Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack and ignited the war, according to the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists. Israel has barred foreign journalists from entering Gaza, giving Palestinian journalists a critical role. Sara Kuda, CPJ's Middle East and North Africa Regional Director, said Israel has a responsibility to conduct a prompt, transparent investigation. When journalists can be killed without credible accountability, it becomes harder and more dangerous for the press to document conflicts and for the public to know what is happening, she said. The lack of answers has been agonizing for families. Ez Eldin Al-Masri said he doesn't understand why his brother, Hussam, was killed. Unfortunately, we found that the blood of journalists in Gaza is cheap, as if the rules protecting journalists do not apply, he said. Daga, 33, had just taken her last photos before rushing up the stairs. Whenever her father, Riyad Abu Daga, visits her grave, he carries her phone and camera. She always had them with her. He visits her apartment near Nasser Hospital and cries. Had any of the daughters of the soldiers been killed unjustly, they would not have stayed silent, he said of the Israelis, they would want to know why. Armed men ambush a patrol in South Sudan and kill 2 UN peacekeepers. Armed men ambushed a patrol traveling to a remote area of South Sudan on Monday, killing 2 UN peacekeepers, the United Nations mission in South Sudan said. Though violence is rampant in the African country, attacks against peacekeepers are rare. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. 7 others were wounded, 3 peacekeepers, 2 members of the South Sudanese police, and 2 civilian staffers. The mission known as UNMISS said in a statement, the 2 peacekeepers killed and 3 injured were from Ethiopia, UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric said. The mission said it had deployed a quick reaction force to secure the area and support the emergency response after the attack. The patrol was going to the area of Pujut in the state of Jonglei when it came under attack. Such deadly violence targeting UNMISS personnel who are serving to support peace in South Sudan is unacceptable, Anita Kiki Gibo, the head of UNMISS, said in the statement. The killings bring the number of peacekeepers killed by militias since January 1st to 9, Dujarric said, stressing that attacks against UN peacekeepers may constitute war crimes under international law. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the ambush in the strongest possible terms and called for a prompt investigation that would lead to the prosecution of those responsible, Dujarric said later Monday. The Secretary General reaffirms the United Nations commitment to stand with the victims and their families during this profoundly difficult time, the spokesman said. Government troops in South Sudan have been combating fighters and militias loyal to opposition leader Riek Machar, who was suspended last year as vice president, as he faces charges of treason and other offenses. Machar says the charges are politically motivated. A 2018 peace deal between President Salva Kiir and Machar, who is under house arrest, has collapsed, leading to fears of a return to full-blown civil war. Between January and July, more than 450 incidents of violence against humanitarian workers and assets were reported, more than double the number recorded during the same period last year, according to UN figures. The conflict escalated in December when opposition forces seized government outposts in Jonglei. The government has been carrying out a counteroffensive since January, with aerial bombardments and ground assaults despite an official commitment to the peace agreement. The United States has urged for talks between Kiir and Machar. Earlier this year, it called for urgent action to uphold peace and mitigate the risk of civil war through an immediate return to dialogue among the parties to the 2018 peace agreement. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 25th issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Brian. Thank you for listening.